And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got a great series of programs for you for the rest of the week. But when we come back, we'll take calls with Paul Wallace, author of the book, The Scars of Eden. Has humanity confused the idea of God with memories of E.T. contact? And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Paul Wallace with us. Paul, you have counseled a number of people who apparently had close encounters. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. The stories that really stick with me are from people who contact me, and they'll say something like, I had this encounter when I was 15 years old. It was of a craft that came down very close to me and was clearly observing me. There was some kind of a communication going on, and I was with one other person at the time. It totally changed my life, but I've never been able to talk to anyone about it. I've told my wife, I've spoken with the person I was with at the time, and I haven't told another living, breathing soul in the 50 years since. So I hear a lot of stories like that from people for whom the power of ridicule has kept them silent on their experience, and they've been really isolated by it. And I have a real heart for people who are in that state and need to process what's happened. And then I hear from others whose experiences are more like mine, really vague. They don't know what happened. They remember the beginning of it, and then they don't know what happened next. And sometimes it's only as they begin to talk about it that they begin to piece together what did happen next. I mean, in my story, I said I fell asleep, but I just don't think it's possible to fall asleep when you're terrified. And as you compare notes, you realize something else happened. And so I've been in conversation with people who do regression therapy, where they help people to talk about what happened, but in a state of deep relaxation. And that sometimes releases the further memories if people are ready and able to process what's happened. Another pattern I've noticed in stories that people share with me is if somebody shares a story and it seems once again that they have the interest of some E.T. Party, mm-hmm. I'll say, did your mom and dad ever have an experience like this? And they'll say, oh, no, I didn't think so. And then about a week later, I get an email from them, and they'll say, oh, I went to my dad, and I shared my story. I'd never told him before. And he opened up about what happened to him when he was 15.
And apparently dad never told anybody before that either.
Dad never told anybody. I was talking to a friend of mine in the ministry the other day who was telling his dad. Now, his dad's about 80. He was telling his dad about the scars of Eden, and he didn't know how his dad would respond to my book. And his dad listened quietly, didn't say anything, got up, went to a cupboard, got a box down from the top of a wardrobe, and then showed his son the drawings his grandfather had made of the craft that had visited him on the farm back in the 1930s,
wow.
I think it was.
What did
so
it look
like? Generations of silence.
What did it look like? Did you see it?
No, I haven't actually seen those papers yet. I would love to, but what got my attention was there was a story in a family, but silent for two generations. And then somebody read The Scars of Eden, and it prompted a conversation where the family was able to open up about what had happened from generation to generation. And I do see a lot of that.
Let's go to the calls. Let's start with Brendan in Austin, Texas, to get us started. Hello, Brendan.
Hello. Thank you guys so much. It's always an honor. Thank you to the staff and the guests and to you.
Thank you.
I'll make it quick. The reason I was calling was because I had gone to Mexico to Chichen Itza. It was an awesome experience. And whenever I was there, the people that were giving me the tour, they had said that over 90% of Chichen Itza is unexcavated. And they do that for a reason, to protect it. And it made me think of how you were saying that, you know, specifically ISIS, and we won't get into all of that, but how they will go in and blow up the ancient civilizations and secrets. And we have that on video. They did that in a lot of different places.
Yep, they sure
we don't
did.
Know why, but, you know, we can extrapolate on that. But so my question is with them trying to protect Chichen Itza by keeping it under the ground and under the dirt because they don't have the resources to protect it, and not a lot of whole people care, especially people with money. So let me get your take on how you think we could best keep the evidence safe in Chichen Itza and excavate at the same time. Should we wait, or should we do it sooner rather than later, considering that there may be clandestine worldwide operations to wipe out our human history and all of the ancient secrets and technology that we have with it?
What do you think of that one, Paul?
Oh, Brendan, that is a really good question. Where I live in Australia at the moment, we're seeing the destruction of Aboriginal sites that carry hard copy of the narratives of the oldest continuous culture in the world. And you talk about Chichen Itza, and I was talking earlier about Iraq. And unfortunately, when it comes to excavations, by the time that you've got the permissions and the money available for that kind of excavation, very often you've got a lot of fingers in the pie from state powers as well. And unfortunately, I think investigation often goes with suppression. In Iraq, Jörg Fassbinder said that the site of Gilgamesh's tomb had been buried to protect it. I'm not sure if it really was buried to protect it or if it is actually being investigated in secret. And that's my view. There's no way they would investigate that in public. And so where you've got something really sensitive that needs to be unearthed and investigated, I think where the potential is for a really significant disclosure, measures are always going to be taken to keep things under wraps and keep things suppressed. So it's really difficult to know how to move forward when you want to see something investigated. We have seen some more positive stories than that, it must be said. I think the excavations at Göbekli Tepe are very interesting, are unearthing things, and we are getting useful information out of there, but it's a really fine balance in knowing how to push those kind of investigations forward.
Next up, let's go to David in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Dave, go ahead.
Yes, sir. This is never brought up, but I think your guest and a bunch of scientists should go out to a place we have in our country called Area 51 and investigate that place. That is, if whoever runs the place would let them in, because I think whatever's going out there would solve a lot of problems about UFOs and whatever else people think they're seeing.
Well, let me tell you, David, you're right, absolutely right, except the government, which runs that place, will not let anybody who's not authorized to come in. If you went to the gates right now, Paul, they wouldn't let you in.
No, indeed. It is really frustrating, but we do live in a world where governments have the power to manage the news to a very great extent, and I use that phrase really broadly, you know, to keep information protected. But there is always leakage. There is always a leakage of information. And in the Scars of Eden, I talk about how that process of leakage happens from century to century. And so I think some information is out there as to what Area 51 is about and what's there. But in terms of, you know, public access, official disclosures, I just would not be holding my breath on that, I'm afraid.
Joe, Long Island, New York. Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions, Paul. One would be, if you look at Job chapter 1 and 2, which is supposedly the oldest book in the Bible, they talk about a character named Satan. Now, Satan supposedly walked on the earth. Now, I don't know if Satan, as mentioned in Job, is the same as Satan in the other sections of the Bible, or even if Satan was an actual demon per se. So that would be my first question. My second question goes to the Garden of Eden. First of all, was there a larger Eden, and this was this the garden? And was Eve talking to a serpent that could actually speak English, or could animals speak English back then, or speak a language, or was she talking to a hybrid being potentially that was acting like a serpent and being deceptive?
Oh, Joe, those are great questions. And you've gone to two texts that any reader is going to read and say, what in the world is going on there? Job is fascinating. You're right. Many scholars believe it's the oldest book in the Bible. Some believe it's an Arabic book that's migrated its way into the Hebrew canon. And you read that story right at the beginning of the dialogue in the Sky Council of God with the Satan character. And you realize that the Sky Council is not anything that fits in a neat and tidy theological box. It is a body on which there are various kinds of entity having an involvement in Project Earth. I don't think that the Satan character in that lines up or is the same as other characters by the same name elsewhere in the Bible. First off, because it is an Arabic story, so it's not part of that continuous narrative. And it's so strange, that conversation, because the lack of empathy for Job shown in that conversation between the God character and the Satan character, it's like boys, you know, playing with ants in a magnifying glass. There's no empathy at all. So I think that story comes from a time when our ancestors were very aware that we were being governed by non-human leaders who had no fellow feeling with us. When we get to Eden, very interesting question about the serpent. The thing that opens that up for me is when you read it alongside the ancient Sumerian texts on which it is based. And when you read the Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian, and Assyrian stories, you realize it's what's happening in Genesis 3 is not a story of a fall and sin and disobedience. It's actually a conflict among ET demographics over how intelligent they want the human beings to be. One faction wants the human so unintelligent they don't even know they're naked, and the other wants to upgrade them. And the one that wants to upgrade them is the one represented by the serpent. And I think the serpent lines up with the character we call Enki in the Mesopotamian stories. And I think there's a great confusion when, in the 6th century BCE, that got told as a God and the devil story. The root story isn't. The root story is about a conflict over how intelligent humanity should be, and over a time when human beings were upgraded. And Eden, it was the enclosed zone where the genetic experiments were being done that produced Homo sapiens sapiens. And I just make that as a statement, but actually when you read it alongside the Mesopotamian stories, that context suddenly clicks and you realize, oh my goodness, that's what we're looking at.
Let's go to Ira, a first-time caller in Des Moines, Iowa. Hello, Ira. You there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sir, go ahead.
George Norrie, I've been listening since you were guest hosting on the Art Bell days. We're talking 20-some years.
We are. We really are, Ira.
An honor and a pleasure. I'm watching you to this day on Gaia TV.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And I want to ask about the Nephilim and the Elohim.
Okay.
And the origin story when it comes to Homo sapiens sapiens. So if we're genetically engineered to be what and who we are, so then how did these beings come to be who we are? How do we have this free will, but yet we're engineered to be, to have free will? At the same time, we're engineered from these beings that came down.
What do you think of that? Assuming we were engineered, why do we have free will?
Ira, that's a great question, and it flows on from what I was just talking to Joe about. And it's not just in the Bible. This whole question is addressed by narratives from Africa, from Mesoamerica, from Greece. And it all reaches the point where those who came and modified our ancestors are really in a conflict over how intelligent they want the humans to be. In Genesis, you have a stage where it looks like they just have males. They're not looking at a fertile species at all. They produce some males. And in the Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan story of beginnings from out of Guatemala, the engineers, and it's funny, that book actually refers to them as those who engineer, their whole goal was to produce workers. They say, let's produce avatars for ourselves to do the work for us and bring us our food. And they do these experiments, and it results in a human being that's too intelligent. It's us plus a bit of precognition, a bit of remote viewing, and they found that too hard to manage. And so they dumbed us down so that we would be smart enough to work for them, but not so smart that we could overpower them. And so in all those experiments, there's a little bit of a push and pull. There's clearly a stage where our ancestors were not as clever as we are. Yes, having free will, but in the way that maybe a horse or a cow might have free will, but can still be herded and controlled. And then that whole discussion in Genesis 3 takes us to another level where we're a little bit smarter than that, and where we do become harder to manage, hence the history of world politics. So even though we're engineered, our ancestors all say we were engineered up to a point where we were more than just clones or drones. We were a fertile species, we could reproduce, and in fact, we had this amazing creativity and, as you say, free will. And it's part of, I think, what makes us such an attractive species.
Let's go to Diana in Clinton, Washington. Hi, Diana. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm calling about General Eisenhower. He was at Muroc Base, but it's now known as Howard Air Force Base. There he met with the Etherians, which are known as the Nordics.
Well, did you ever hear the story of Eisenhower meeting with ETs, Paul?
Yes, I have heard that story, and I do give it some credence. There are a number of things that I've heard that suggest there has been contact with Nordic-looking people who've been involved in negotiations since the 1940s. When I said earlier that Haim Ashed had made his revelations because he's hoping we can do better diplomacy, I actually think it's what people call the Nordics who are most likely to be helpful to us in those conversations. And some relate them to the Pleiadians as well. And I do think that in the spectrum of ET demographics that are involved in Project Earth, we have people like that who are worth having alliances with, who are interested in us, who like us, who have a nurturing relationship with us, who don't want us blowing ourselves to bits. And I think that was an aspect of those meetings that you, Diana, were referring to.
Paul, we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast as we talk about your book, The Scars of Eden. And the subtitle, again, is really catchy, folks. Has humanity confused the idea of God with memories of ET contact? Eric Von Daniken, Chariots of the Gods, loves this book. And he loves all of Paul's work. So we're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment here on Coast to Coast. Paul's website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our free YouTube channel by going to Coast to Coast AM Official when you get to YouTube. Put it up there in the search bar. On our next Coast to Coast program, I'll be here with Dr. Robert Lustig as we talk about strange diseases. And then later on in the show, we are going to talk about diseases on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come back in a moment with Paul Wallace and take final calls. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie back with you. Our final segment with Paul Wallace here as we're talking about his work, The Scars of Eden. And Paul, the book is available now.
Yes, it's available. You can go to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold, and you'll be able to get The Scars of Eden. It's available as a paperback and in Kindle as well.
Super. Let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Louise in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Louise. Welcome.
Hello, George. Thank you for accepting my call.
You
this
are
is something
okay.
that you never hear about, and many people don't know about it. In the book of Genesis, chapter 1, days 1 through 5, God said he created the heavens and the earth, the sun, the moon, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Day 6, the pronoun God changes when God said, let us make man in our image. This is day 6. Created male and female. He created male and female. Then you go, on the seventh day, God rested. Then you go to chapter 2, and God, again, we go back to the singular God when he created Adam and Eve. Two sets of men were created, chapter 1, day 6, and chapter 2 with Adam and Eve. I would like to have your guest's opinion on this subject.
All right. Go for it, Paul.
Louise, that is fascinating what you've pointed out there. I think what a lot of people don't realize when they start reading Genesis is that they're reading a library of books. And that, you know, we think of the Bible as a single book you can read cover to cover. But, of course, the Bible itself is a collection of books. And within that, Genesis is a collection of books, a collection of scrolls. If we were looking, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, you'd be looking at a cupboard full of scrolls. And the scrolls bring together different stories of beginnings. So as you rightly say, there are two accounts of the creation of human beings side by side. So you've got two different scrolls from different sources telling the story. And if you read carefully, you can see to this day where one scroll stops and the next starts, because you can see a change in the story, there's a change in context, there's a leap in time frame. And I actually think it's one of the keys, one of the first keys you need to begin opening up Genesis, to realize you're looking at a whole sequence of stories that have been put side by side and then brought together into a single work. And I, in The Scars of Eden, I go through some of the history of how these books came to be put together, what the sources were, what the theologians were doing as they knit it into a single story, and what the stories were before. So you've touched on a really live question there, Louise, and I take my hat off to you for doing that.
Could God have created extraterrestrials to seed the universe?
Well, when we use the word God, I like the way the Apostle Paul defines it, the source of the cosmos and everything in it.
Yeah.
And so I think that every kind of entity that we're looking at has its roots in that same zero point. So we're all part of the same experience, the same experiment. We're different to one another. We conflict with one another. But it's like there's this great cosmic question as to whether we can coexist together and what that might look like. And I think that's what the experiment of panspermia is all about.
Joe in Monterey, California. Joseph, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Welcome, Joe.
Paul, you do brilliant work, I must admit. There is a reason why I'm asking these questions or getting to a specific point. I do know the answer, but I want to know if there's any indication or any kind of documentation that you found to validate this. One premise would be, do you believe that maybe there are, on other planets, they have their counterpart of angels and archangels the way we do? And if so, if there's reincarnation on their planet, could angels be reincarnating back and forth on their planet? Also, the Mayans disappeared overnight, practically. That's what they say. And they blame it on some kind of disease. The Mayans were so advanced, they would have known how to stop a disease. They had shamans. They had all kinds of contact from the other side. Could it be that they were living with a race that offered them to leave with them because times were getting very difficult for them? They saw it coming. Also, when they re-engineer, it might not be to have slaves. Maybe they're trying to adjust the bodies of the humans at the time to be more compatible with them so they can incarnate. And when they found us naked, it must have took a long time to make that decision to put clothes on us.
What do you think of that, Paul?
Oh, Joe, that's a sequence of really interesting questions. The Mayan question is fascinating, and there are a number of civilizations. It's a little bit puzzling as to why exactly they disappeared so quickly from where they did. There are hints, even in the Bible, of populations being taken away in vast craft, and you have to wonder if that's part of the story. In the book of Revelation, there's a city it's described as coming down from the heavens, and it's a cube, and it's clearly a cube-type craft of enormous proportions, and it's going to take away tens of thousands of people. when our ancestors who had no language of space travel tell stories like that, you wonder the scale of the thing that they are remembering, don't you? So that question about the Mayans touches on that or relates to that. The angels question and other planet is fascinating. Way back in 1600, there was a theologian called Giordano Bruno who said that he believed that other planets had other populations on them and that they were creatures of the same creator. They were people like us. They may even be more perfected than we are, he said. And he hinted at the possibility of a connection with them in consciousness, or that we might reincarnate on one of their planets. And when he said that, he was repeating what Plato had said 2,500 years ago. It really interests me that some of the very early church fathers had no problem talking about all those concepts, and they would seem pretty fringy in the 21st century if you try and have conversations like that in churches today. But back in the beginning, that was all on the table. And Plato was very interested in consciousness and did think that the continuation of our consciousness might involve us with lives on other planets. And as to the place of angels, well, as I was just saying before, you know, we're in a populated universe. There's a great spectrum of beings. There's this great question out there as to whether we can live in love and harmony and order. And I wonder if some of these angels who get labeled that way simply refer to entities and beings who are better aligned with that harmony and with that compassion and that help than others. I wonder if that's how our ancestors told those stories.
That's very possible.
Those are my thoughts.
East of the Rockies, Don in Kent, Ohio. Hi, Don.
Hey, God bless you, Brother George and Paul. Great show. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, regarding transpermia, and before that it was panspermia from the ancient Greeks, and
yeah.
Cosmozoic theory of the 1880s are all excuses for the abject failure of evolution. The only way that you can explain the Big Bang, something from nothing, is only it works for a creator God. When you look at the Cambrian explosion, you have a sudden appearance of well-defined creatures in that. And, you know, the new translations, Bible students and prophecy students, they find them to be very, you know, undependable. When you consider Jacob's ladder of Genesis 28, there was no noise, no exhaust. And in Acts 12, the angel that rescues Peter from prison, the guards, none of them even woke up. And when you look at the experiencers, you know, they often have problems that follows their abductions. They have sleep disruptions, skin rashes, psychological disruptions. All these are issues that occur with demon-possessed victims. Well, what say you?
Wow, Don, that's fascinating. Remind me of your first point, because I really wanted to come back to that.
Oh, yeah? Well, it was about transpermazoa.
Transpermia.
Yes, I agree, Don, with what you're saying. I think that evolution on its own and a naturalistic explanation isn't sufficient to explain life on Earth or us as the alpha species. There's a gap in our ability to explain ourselves. And it was that when I was 11 years old, got my attention from Eric von Daniken, that he had named that gap. And he wasn't the first to do it, because Plato, 2,500 years ago, said the same thing. He believed that life evolved on Earth, but he said that you don't get to a species like us without an intervention from outside. And that's what he argued for, that some of our older sisters and brothers in the picture of panspermia had come and modified us and upgraded us to be intelligent, conscious, technological, because without that, we're not the alpha presence on planet Earth. And so I think you've identified very correctly the gap that our conventional stories can't answer until we allow for this wider picture.
Paul, wouldn't you have loved to have been back in that time period to witness all these things?
I'm quite happy to live in 2021 right now. I think, you know, every era has its excitements and its challenges. I would love to be able to remote view it all. I'll put it that way.
All right, that's well done. Paul, thanks. Stay in touch with us. What's your next work?
Oh, I'm working on a sequel to The Scars of Eden, and it's looking at what was the knowledge that got buried along with
our ancestors' knowledge of ETs. So if you keep up with me through paulanthonywallace.com or through the Fifth Kind TV on YouTube or the Paul Wallace channel, you'll be able to follow me as I make that journey of research on that topic.
Super, Paul. Thank you. When that next book's done, you get a hold of us. For Michael Cosio, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.